Council, you ready?
Yeah.
Anything for me?
No, thanks.
All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Siegel, Judge Raffel, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning, you're seated.
Good morning.
Welcome to live Court of Appeals from March 9. It's great to see your faces live. You will look great on computer too, but this is really the way it ought to be.
Can you hear me better now? Well, at least the recording can hear me better. You could all hear me anyway in here. And I was just looking at my records that it's almost exactly 2 years this month, the last time I was in a courtroom live, and so it's nice to be where we're supposed to be. You'll see we still have some vestiges of precautions that probably will be around for a bit. That's why we got the two microphones, and you're a little further apart for that reason. Also, as a result of that, the only clock you see is on the middle original microphone. But I stood down there a couple days ago, and it looks like it's visible. You just have to once in a while look over and keep an eye on that. Otherwise, other rules would be the same. Also, you've received the little microphone shower caps, I'll call them. And when you're done, we do ask that you take those with you. They're disposable, but certainly if you want to keep it as a souvenir, that's your prerogative as well. I'll identify the first case by its file number first, A211378, Brian Leslie Franklin, appellant, versus Drew Evans, superintendent, Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, is the respondent. We do ask counsel to identify yourself when you begin your arguments, and we'll begin with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bradford Colbert. I represent the appellant in this matter, Brian Franklin. The issue before the court this morning is whether Mr. Franklin's lawsuit is barred by the statute of limitations. Mr. Franklin's lawsuit is not barred for two reasons. First, his lawsuit is not barred because the act of requiring him to register as a predatory offender is a continuing violation, and therefore the statute of limitations is tolled or has not yet begun. Second, even if the act requiring a person does not toll the statute of limitations generally. In this case, Mr. Franklin's lawsuit is not barred because the BCA extended Mr. Franklin's registration period most recently in June of 2021. I think it's important to start by discussing the unique nature of Minnesota's predatory offender laws.
Mr. Colbert, could I just clarify that last point you made? When you say extended, so was that a new violation basis that extended it versus the annual renewal period that the statute otherwise requires?
It was extended because he was incarcerated, and that was a result of his incarceration. It's been extended a couple times, most recently, I think, in June of 2021.
So what is the key distinction? I know I'm turning your arguments around a little bit because it was your last point. What's the key distinction of whether one's simply re-registering or extended, but still has to continue to re-register annually and all the other obligations remain the same?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it goes to the unique nature of the Minnesota's predatory offender statute, because, in fact, he's not sentenced to a registration period. It is a period of years, and it is, the court doesn't say, like conditional release, for example, you're sentenced to so much time in conditional release. It's determined by some correction agents, or the BCA. In this case, it was determined that he was supposed to register for 10 years in 2009. And at that time, again, it was not a court decision. It was not done. It was someone, in this particular case, was the correction agents, determined that he was supposed to register, and then every year he needed to do an annual registration or whether he moved. Because he was incarcerated and had committed a new offense, the BCA then, again, not a court, but someone from the BCA or through the corrections, extended the registration. No formal process. They just determined that the statute says it needs to be extended, and they extended it. So that's what I'm referring to. So the original, his original registration period, again, not imposed by the court, the original registration period would have been ended in 2019. But they extended it, and again, they extended it in 2021.
By the way, you kept referring to no order by the court. Isn't it true all registration, a court need not order it? It just happens as a matter of law under the statute. So whether a court is silent on it or suggests maybe you don't have to, if they have to, the BCA will require them to do so.
Correct, Your Honor. And in fact, the judge can't modify. I mean, it is, and the question about whether it's imposed as a matter of law, I think is a difficult issue because, again, that points to the unique nature of it because it's not imposed by law. It can't be imposed by law. For example, who is able to determine whether it arises from the same set of circumstances? And so it isn't. There is no determination. There is no process by which this is done. There's no adversarial process. Someone, usually a correction agent, tells the other person, tells Mr. Franklin, that he needs to register. That's how it's done. And then he needs to register, even though a court hasn't imposed it. And in this case, you can see where the peculiar nature of it is even more peculiar in this case, because Mr. Franklin wasn't ever convicted of a predatory offense. And in fact, he wasn't even charged with a sexual offense. His alleged crime was a kidnapping that occurred during a robbery. And then he was told while at the prison that he needed to register as a predatory offender. And as you might imagine, that if being told by your caseworker or whoever at the prison, it's difficult to contradict, and there's really nothing he can do to contradict it. They're not asking, they're not saying, what do you think about this? They're saying you need to register. And the only way to contest registration in Minnesota is by a lawsuit. The only way to do it is by a lawsuit, is to allege that you are improperly requiring me to register as a predatory offender. And that's why this particular lawsuit is important. Because this is the only way a person can get a judicial decision as to whether he is supposed to register. Otherwise, it's up to the corrections.
On that point, Mr. Colbert, isn't it true, though, that, and we've had cases in which the issue of, the factual issue of whether it arose under the same circumstances has been determined by the sentencing court, and so which I assume is the most common specific argument that I ought not to be subject to the registration. So when you say there's no judicial, no method other than lawsuit, civil lawsuit as your client has commenced, there is that criminal basis that would be appropriate to raise that issue.
It's not clear. I mean, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor, is that there have been court decisions determining whether that's arising from the same set of circumstances. It's not clear procedurally how that's done, frankly, right? Because it isn't the determination. The court's not making a registration determination. That's not what the court's determining. And so is it, again, it goes to the problematic nature of the law. Is it in the complaint that they're rising from the same set of circumstances? So the court just look at the complaint? Is it look at the testimony? The same issue in what's arose here at the trial court level is probable cause. We're alleging that there was insufficient probable cause. And that particular complaint
was kidnapping charge.
Sorry?
For the kidnapping charge.
Exactly right.
Okay.
And so that piece of it has not. And so what we're asking for.
You haven't done that in a criminal proceeding though, right? Or did I miss that?
I'm sorry, say it again.
You have challenged the probable cause?
No, they dismissed
the
kidnapping.
Just in the civil suit, right?
Right, yes.
Yeah.
No, they dismissed the kidnapping.
Yeah.
And again, what's important is they dismissed the kidnapping and it did not arise. And so to your point, Judge, is that it didn't arise. No one said you need to register as a predatory offender. And so there was no determination as to whether there was an initial determination of the complaint with the kidnapping charge, but the court didn't look at it in the terms of registration because it didn't come up during the criminal proceedings, which again, I think is this nature of the Minnesota's, I'm going to say charitably, unique registration statute.
So Judge Sleater, I didn't mean to interrupt you in your line of questionings, but I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Colbert, just to make sure I'm clear on your argument. I think I am, but I'm could be wrong. What you're laying out, what I hear you talking about here, is the important nature of this claim to your client because it's his only opportunity. Maybe there's a chance to do what Judge Sleater's talking about, but that's not what's happened here. There hasn't been a criminal proceeding challenging this registration requirement. You're looking at a civil claim. I appreciate that. And in fact, recognize the really strong policy arguments that you have and that there is a lot of debate about the merits and demerits of offender registration, particularly for a situation such as this one where there's a charge and no conviction. Here's what I'm struggling with a bit. I think I see it in your brief, but I want to make sure I'm clear on it. You don't dispute that Mr. Franklin's claims accrued in 2009, right?
We're not disputing that he was told to register in 2009. That is not.
Not my question, though.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm
Did his claim, his civil claim, the complaint that has been filed in this case, I think in 2020, did that those claims accrue in 2009? Because we're here just on a statute of limitations issue. That's the only issue that was decided below.
Correct.
As you said at the beginning of your argument.
Well, what I would suggest is that two things to that, Your Honor. One is the renewal of the extension of the registration is a new cause of action.
And that's in your complaint?
That is, I'm not sure it's in the complaint.
Yeah, I didn't find it.
Okay, yeah. So it's a new cause of action. The idea that the extending of the extension of it is what makes this. That makes it a new cause of action. And to that point, I mean,
but
that's...
You do think that argument is in your brief?
It's in the reply brief.
It is.
It's definitely in the reply brief. And so that point is the idea, and it has to go with the idea of what happens with registration. For example, when the legislature changes the rules regarding people who will have to register, they apply it to everyone. And so that changes it. And that, the same, for example, if he were to go to prison and they were to determine that he were a level one or two or three, that all changes. So it is this movable piece of it, the fact of registration. And that's what Judge Castro, in the reply brief, I referred to Judge Castro's decision in Drobak versus Evans. And what Judge Castro said is the possibility that someone is going to have to register for the rest of their lives and not be able to get a judicial determination as to whether they're actually supposed to register is an absurdity.
So
That has to do with the extension.
If you don't mind, if I can ask one more thing, because it's important to me, the complaint that you presented and the theories that you presented. Did those causes of action accrue in 2009? Because you've now articulated a different theory, you know, the extension requirement.
And again, I'm sorry, I don't know what we put in the complaint. And so I think...
Well, just assume for a moment that I don't see the extension alleged in the complaint. And it certainly didn't happen at the time that you filed the complaint.
Right.
I mean, based on what you just said.
Yeah, and again, yeah. I don't know. What I can say is we put it in a reply brief, and there is no question, I think, in their brief, that's why the idea that they extended in 2021. So that's there as well.
This is what I'm struggling with. See, so now the whole continuing violation focuses on the extension that the BCA imposed? Is that your theory?
I'm saying that's so, and that's...
Because that's not what I saw in your opening brief.
Correct. It was in my reply brief, in the sense of it is in the reply brief. And so that piece of it, and I agree, I don't think it was in my opening brief. It was definitely in the reply brief. And so that's... But I don't want to lose the... It is also a continuing violation. So that's where, when you talk about does it accrue, it accrues when he is required to register. And that's what the Georgia Supreme Court found in Cardi versus Conway, which I cited in my supplement authority. That case is directly on point and contradicts this court's opinion in John Jones versus Evans. It's directly.
Judge Brappold, are you? Okay. So moving back to your continuing violation theory, you have several causes of action counts in your complaint. Procedural and substantive due process, but you also have a count for an Eighth Amendment violation for cruel and unusual punishment. So the case law mostly arises in the employment discrimination context, makes a distinction between the act, the decision, the wrongful conduct, unlawful conduct, and the continuing effects of that. With if it's just the effects, that's a problem. But with cruel and unusual punishment, it seems like that focuses on the effects. So can you talk a little bit about what that count is about?
So
is the trigger then the effect is what I'm asking.
I mean, I have to say, so what's I think the law regarding this area, at least to me, is a bit muddled. And the idea of what's a continuing effect and what's a continuing violation, I think, is a bit muddled. But what I would suggest is what the big distinction is whether it can be abated. So, for example, if someone is assaulted and then you sue someone for the assault, the fact that they're damaged in some other way differently down the road, that their damages that they didn't discover, you can't undo the assault. So what we're asking here, and I see that my time is coming down, but it's important, what we're asking here
isn't... But wait, I don't think you're getting to my question.
I'm sorry, and it's a roundabout way, and I apologize.
Okay. So my question is, with cruel and unusual punishment, was there one instance of it, and if so, when, or is it an ongoing... The punishment is ongoing because he has to continually register. In which case, I mean, possibly you could argue, but I want to find out if you are arguing that this ongoing punishment is the cause of action in that third count.
So to be honest, I don't think we argued cruel and unusual in our memo to the court. So that isn't what we argued was the substantive due process, and so that's and so I. I'm
so con- you're dropping your well, cruel and unusual argued punishment.
It was not argued in a memo, and so what the court said, though, I mean, to be clear, the
and
court
Mr.
didn't Colbert, address
you need to
any of those
answering,
claims.
You know, your time's expired. Finish yep. answering.
Sorry. Thank you.
If you have more, no, my point being is you can finish answering.
Right. So the point, I think, is my major point is it's the registration and what we're asking to. And I think this court, it's really important to look at Gardy versus Conway. I think that contradicts this court's decision to Jones versus Evans. And that shows that it's the registration is where the cause of action accrues, not the determination. It's the act of forcing someone to register. Thank you.
Thank you. Council for respondent, you may identify yourself, and when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case. So I really think this case boils down to the Hammond versus Park Nicollet Supreme Court precedent and this court's persuasive opinion in the Jones case. And those two authorities, the precedent and the persuasive authority, support the district court's decision in this case dismissing on statute of limitations grounds. And I would say with respect to Mr. Colbert, or the appellant, did not raise these issues in the complaint as far as the extension of the registration. And I think it would be a different case and a different issue if those extensions were done illegally. That's a different thing. If he's saying, I didn't commit a new crime and go to prison, yet I was extended, that's a different cause of action. That's saying the BCA improperly extended his registration. That didn't happen here. That's not alleged here. The BCA, pursuant to the statutory requirements, extended his registration when he was reincarcerated on new offenses.
If he had pled that, though, would the extension be within the statute of limitations?
If he had pled that the extension was illegal, I think that's a different case. I don't know what that would be based on, but yes, that would be within the statute of limitations if the extension was done illegally. But that's not what happened here.
So, Ms. Kiza, let me just follow up quickly on that. When you say illegally, you're saying if it was done, if the extension was done not in accordance with statute?
Correct.
So I'm troubled by that argument. It seems to me that if you're conceding that there is a newly accrued cause of action based on the BCA extending, hypothetically, because you are clearly arguing that that's not in front of this court,
right.
But hypothetically, if you're doing that, it seems to me the constitutional claims that have been raised by Mr. Franklin are quite different from saying that the extension was done improperly under state law.
Correct.
It is saying that those are invalid.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
As a violation of substantive due process and other grounds. So why would that cause of action not be triggered by the extension?
Okay, so because from a statute of limitations standpoint, at the time that he was required to register and up until those 6 years, he knew at the time those extensions were part of the statute. They've been part of the statute for decades. He knew of the potential criminal consequences. He knew of, so in 2015, if he had an issue with those extensions, he would have been able to bring that within the statute of limitations. So I guess my...
It doesn't make sense, Ms. Kiza. If it wasn't extended until 2020, how could he have challenged them on constitutional grounds in 2009? He could challenge the initial registration requirement. He couldn't challenge the extension.
Well,
this lifetime argument that is being made by Mr. Colbert.
He actually was extended before 2021, I think he was extended a number of times.
It's fine. I mean, whatever those facts are, which, as you said, are not in front of us, apparently,
right.
At least weren't alleged.
Right.
But hypothetically, I'm struggling with your argument in the hypothetical.
I guess my point being that there could potentially be a different cause of action, not in this case, but there's somebody who was wrongly treated, which didn't happen with this appellant, could bring a cause of action if it was appropriate, if there was an actual violation of the statute itself, I guess is what I was trying to say. But my point is that Hammond rules here from a continuing violation standpoint, and that the Jones case is persuasive on that and is on point as far as he was required to register as of 2009. He knew that. He knew of the potential consequences of that. As far as any kinds of extensions, any kinds of criminal, the annual verification process. So any time between then and when the statute of limitations expired, he could have raised those kinds of claims. And these claims that he does raise in his complaint, he could have raised any of those by 2015.
Ms. Kiza, can I ask you, I'm thinking of the language from Segerson, that's the case everybody cites for the exception, and I did see in the complaint allegations that while in custody, there was harm caused by the registration, and then the phrase, I think, will be harm in the future, and we can presume there's harm. And the Segerson court uses the quote that we'd look, the focus is at the time of the discriminatory act, and the question is whether, not just whether it's ongoing, but whether a present violation exists. And one of the ways it seems like the courts in the employment law cases talk about the exception is if the wrongdoer has the option, has the ability to stop the wrong that's being committed, that's one way you look at the whether it's an ongoing harm that's continuing in those cases, which is, I think, the argument, at least in one sense, being made here. So my question for you, if we assume, which I assume we would at this procedural posture of the case, that there's a constitutional harm or violation by requiring the registration, wouldn't it be true that the BCA at any time could stop the harm by saying, oh, we made a mistake, you don't have to register, hence it's an ongoing harm, and until that harm is stopped, like in the employment law cases where there's ongoing discrimination, as soon as they stop the discrimination, then we have the accrual, I assume, was part of the question that was asked by Judge Bradfield. I mean, isn't that, because everybody agrees it's an ongoing obligation.
Well, as the court indicated before, this is a statutory requirement, so the BCA can't just say, oh, you know, I mean, they could, if the law changed, I think this is something that the appellant raised in the reply brief.
I think the question was that to presume, because we're here just dealing with the statute of limitations issue, presume that there was a constitutional violation. And was it continuing? I don't mean to put words in your mouth.
And that's part of why I asked it that way, because the judge specifically didn't address, I think, other arguments your client had that it ought to be dismissed, but stopped at the statute of limitations, so that's where we stop, and we presume the allegations to be true for limitations purposes.
Right. So if you said that the statute of limitations didn't prohibit his claims, and if the court then said he was unconstitutionally required to register, yes, the BCA could take him off the registry. Is that?
Well, I was more focusing on the Segerson case, the line, since that's, I think, the only basis one Mr. Colbert's client can successfully, because no one's disputing the 6 years has long been run. Mm-hmm. But in those cases where it's told, it's because the ongoing harm, the harm that's causing, in those cases, discrimination, until it stops, they're still being discriminated against, hence there's a tolling. So the accrual doesn't begin until the employer says, oh, okay, I'll no longer discriminate, I'll pay you what you're worth, and et cetera. I'm trying to see why you think that doesn't fit in this scenario where we presume there's a constitutional wrong been done, and he's having to re-register, he's having to extend, it has all the adverse effects that I think we could all stipulate to of registration.
Well, because those are all consequences of the initial determination of registration. It's not like the BCA every year is making a determination. Per the statute, there's a triggering of a, you know, once they're registered, there's this verification process where basically there's a letter sent out and they sign it that the information is still accurate or whatever. But they're not every year saying, oh, let's look at him again and see if he has to register. They make that one determination, which they made in 2009. Everything else are ongoing consequences, and that's where the Hammond decision governs here and not the employment discrimination cases. And actually, our Supreme Court has not been willing to extend this even to due process cases, as this court noted in the Jones decision. So I do not think that's the same as the employment discrimination cases. I think it's a case where everything else are consequences of that initial determination that the BCA made in 2009. And
so can I ask you the same question I asked Mr. Colbert? And that's, there is this cruel and unusual punishment count, which seems like the harm in that is the continuing effects of the registration decision. So the violation then is that it's causing me ongoing punishment because I have to keep registering, I can't get jobs, I can't get housing, and if I don't register, I'm guilty of a felony. So why is that not an ongoing kind of violation claim that doesn't go back? I mean, it started with the initial registration, but what's your response to that? Because I'm trying to sort through all this, the violation versus the ongoing effects. And
right. You know, and I don't really know that it's much different from the consequences from a due process standpoint. They're the same, you know, it's the same issue that these all stem from that initial determination. So I just think it's the same thing. It's from a Hamman standpoint, that determination was made in 2009. Anything that he's alleging to be cruel and unusual punishment, which is quite a stretch since this is a civil regulatory statute, but in any event, those would, again, be consequences from that initial determination, so it would be late to make that claim. It would be beyond the statute of limitations to make that claim, too, I would say. I wanted to address just a couple of things that came up in the reply brief in this case. One thing is in Jones' case, in distinguishing Jones in the reply brief, the appellant states that Jones is different because he was convicted of third-degree criminal sexual conduct. It wasn't the same set of circumstances case. That is not, in fact, true. It was a very similar case. Jones was charged with third-degree criminal sex, but he was convicted of fifth-degree criminal sex, so it was the same type of case. It was the same set of circumstances case. And then as far as the Georgia case that, two different things. He brings up Lewison versus Hutchinson in his initial brief, and I would distinguish that case because that was the case that dealt with the voter registration signs, and I would distinguish that case because there was a conscious decision by the Hutchinsons, the people Hutchinson knew anyway, to leave those signs up, you know, each day. So I would distinguish that in this case because, again, once the BCA makes that initial determination that the statute applies, that's not something that they continue to make every day. And then with respect to the Georgia case, I would just respectfully disagree with the Garde decision. I did agree with the Court of Appeals, and I do think that the Court of Appeals in that, in the Garde case, is in line with what our Supreme Court has done on the continuing violation cases. The facts do differ somewhat in Garde. That was a situation where he actually moved out of state, and then the Georgia registration was keeping him registered in another state. And so it was more of an ongoing issue with him. He didn't have to register in the initial state where he committed the crime. So factually,
Oh, I'm sorry, finish up. I've got one more quick question.
Okay, yeah, I was just going to say that factually there were some distinctions there as far as the relief that he was requesting. And then also they made a kind of a thing in that case about the annual registration and the criminal liability every year. In our state, any violation of the law is a felony from the time you register that's ongoing. So this annual thing is one of, I guess, many things that could potentially result in criminal liability, and that's something somebody knows from the time they have to register.
Which kind of leads into my question about the Longoria case. Mm-hmm. So why isn't sauce for the goose sauce for the gander?
Well, because in Jones addressed Longoria decision too, but if you look at, I mean, Longoria is a criminal case, so it deals with the criminal statute of limitations, and then Longoria, once he violated the criminal statute and wasn't registering properly, he continued to violate that every day. He could have come into compliance at any time, and then the new statute of limitations would trigger for a new criminal offense. So that's the difference in that case, is there's not a... he intentionally was not registering every day. He was making that decision every day not to comply with registration. once he came into compliance, then, you know, there would be a new statute of limitations period for the next time Longoria would potentially violate that statute.
And you're down to 4 seconds, so you want to summarize or conclude?
Sorry. Thank you. I will just ask the court to affirm the district court decision dismissing the case. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Colbert, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. As you pointed out, I would hope that if someone were to point to the BCA and say, this is, I'm not supposed to register, that the BCA would look at it and say, you're right. You're right. I'm sorry, we made a mistake. You're not supposed to register, which I think goes to your point. Then that would stop. And what is important here is the relief we're requesting. And this is what comes out in Gardy versus Conway. We're not asking for damages. We're not saying, asking for damages for what happened in the past. All we're asking for is a declaration that he not be required to register as a predatory offender and that he and that be enjoined from requiring to register. That is a distinction. And that distinction is recognized in Gardy. I think, I tried to distinguish in Jones versus Evans in my brief, I don't think it's distinguishable. I think this court is going to have to decide whether Jones v. Evans, the principles established there, or the more recent case at Gardy versus Conway, the idea that in what the Supreme Court says, that the cause of action accrues not when the plaintiff became aware of sufficient facts to pursue a constitutional claim, but rather when the plaintiff suffered the injury that completed the tort. And that's our point here, is that it is the ongoing registration. And I want to end with the recognition that people who should not be required to register should not be required to register. That's what we're asking for here. We're just asking for the ability to show that he should not be required to register.
But Mr. Colbert, doesn't that exist? And it seems like a separate issue because we know, regardless of the party's position, the person has 6 years from the first day they are asked to register.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That's the statute of limitations. He was told he's supposed to register. I do think it's important to note he was told while he's in prison. There aren't a lot of legal services to people. We're like the only organization. The idea that you have to file a lawsuit, there's not an administrative procedure. He's not given notice that say, here's what we've decided, you're supposed to register. If you want to challenge this, here's the process by which you challenge. He is told while incarcerated that he needs to register. I can't imagine that he would think, okay, maybe I need to file a lawsuit and allege that this is violation of due process, because it doesn't seem. So that, again, goes to the unique nature of this and the problematic nature of this. And I think that this court's in Jones versus Evans made it even more a statute that's difficult, made it more difficult for people. And what we're asking is for a chance to determine whether, in fact, he should have to register as a predatory offender. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today, and we will take the matter under advisement. Yes, feel free to take your guest microphone cover, and thank you for your comments. Have a good day.
You too. Fun to see everyone live.
Yes, indeed. And we get to see the smiling faces, so that's a plus.
Smiling when we're done, for sure.
Are both counsel here for the next matter? Aaron Wester, appellant versus State Farm Fire and Casualty Company. You're welcome to make your way when there's room to the tables.